this is starting to become a
high. Now, we'll run out of tape on the other. Wait just a minute.
See if I can get that.
We run out of tape on the other side of this reel, and Ben Fowles was talking about Livengood and about the mining claims up there and about Tony Lindstrom. So he'll carry on from there.
Yeah.
Judy asked you about claim jumpers. People come in and jump your claim.
Well, I didn't want to tell about that.
Well, you don't have to use names, Ben.
Now, we have a little intermission because Ben would like to talk about some incidents up there, not naming anybody, so there'll be nothing libelous on it, about claim jumping.
Now, go ahead.
Well, Wilbur Frick, when it first was stampeded, people prospected, put many holes down on the creek. I did myself a three holes myself up on 12, as we had a couple of claims way up on 12 above, where we took bench and creek together. And I believe there was at least 100 holes put on the creek part of that, river creek. And nobody found anything but a gold color show. I had gone into the bench site the first year and I didn't find any gold there. But I did cover the hole and leave what junk I had there, thinking maybe I might go back sometime and see if I could find more. And nobody found anything but what the fellow down at the Discoverer, this Jack Wilbert, just called him Wilbert. He hadn't found any, only a little bedrock coarse gold that was panning 10 cents anyway at the most, and not anything of paste, turf, of any body to it. But I mean, it was just coarse gold, and you know, when you find coarse gold, a lot of people think, well, there must be a pay streak there someplace. That's all there is to do to find it. And a good many of them will dig like everything for it. The same as myself. I've been putting quite a few holes on that stick from the time that I have, after I get through in the fall down where I had shallow ground near Livengood. I went up there, my wife and I stayed over three different winters up there, and we had built a nice cabin, and we had, after I bought a couple of claims near the mouth of the creek. Well, there, I sold that to Tony Lindstrom when he came along from being mining a turkey, and he didn't find any money. But Tony is one of the partners of the Good News Bay Platinum Miners, owners of the dredge of the company. But a sentence interest, he told me, and he afterwards had, well, he'd had this property, and it was bringing in so much good money that he was investing it, and he went to a circle, and he didn't succeed there, so he came over to Lightwood, and he met me on Level Creek, and I sold him this claim that I had bought from a couple of fellows that couldn't find any gold on it, and nobody else found any gold anywhere except at the mouth of the creek. It was panning a little spot here and there, of course, gold, you know. And the Brown brothers that owned this ground, and Tom Verdi were the ones that staked it long after the first stampede. It all went out, and nobody thought there was anything much to do with it in the creek. But they found and dug up a gold that was $300 and filled it down at the store that started another stampede. And back up again. Well, I didn't want anything to do with the creek, but I knew all about that. And I said, well, boys, we guess we better go back and see if we can find the pay up at the on the benches. Which a couple of more fellas got telling about, and of course I had a half a dozen fellas that went with me, and we went up on the benches. And you know, it wasn't on the first tier. It was in the second and third tier high. And it was just as like it was on Leiden, but nobody found, the discoverers never found the payback on the benches, you know. The first people that went there found the creek had a little low grade pay, you know, Tom. But there was Dave Caskitten, an old timer that was mining here for years, and he had five different fellows with him, you know, just as good playboys around. And if it was to stick him in claims, he was getting him on half of it.
No.
Naturally, there was nothing to stake when he came over. He came on for days, all right. And so, funny part of that was, they just got there and got monotonous, eating up the groceries and nothing to do. Way back in the third tier, on Leidenburg, benches. That 2,300 feet away from the present creek where it is now. And there they have tent and camp and their border and their crop and everything, and they're eating up, doing nothing, only just wrangling with themselves. And but finally, one of them, Albert Berg, says to me, told me this himself. He says, what's the matter? We put a hole down here. Just something for something to do, you know. And they got the border set up, and they all agreed with that, and they started to sink the hole. And they kept going down deeper, not striking any bedrock, and they kept going a step deeper. And they went over 100 feet to deep and stuck this channel way back. But nobody would expect to do that.
But they were 100 feet down?
Yes. And they stuck the real face way back there. It afterwards was lined up by name, and that come in Gus Peterson and company, and I don't know a good deal of money more. Lined that face stick up for 4 miles, and you could shoot a rifle ball straight over it. And you had no trouble to find it, one would line the other up, and it'd come out all right. You know that, Tom?
That's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. You find it out on the
front. There's a clear down, even with the town alike. But from there on,
you know,
it seems
to
spread out.
Yeah.
Very easy.
Very easy.
But of course, I was interested in the river creek. I'm telling you this because it struck me that in the vicinity, it's likewise. So on every creek around it, in a camp, in a new camp. And the same thing showed it on River Creek. The Gold Course Gold Channel laid way back 2,300 feet there. I measured the distance to know I'm not telling you right. Yes, I know these things. I've been picked the holes myself. I've been down with three holes that was over 100 feet deep and three or four more that was half that depth. That just because our mining during the summer season was a hydraulic open-cut method. You can't do anything in winter time. The winter months is long, so there was something to do. When you're young and able to do it, you want to do something like try and find that pastry.
Then, how did they sink the holes in the winter? When I come in the country, I saw fires all over the country.
I can explain that. That in the very first year that I was in the Fairbanks district here, we had some interest that we had to sink so many holes on these interests all around from Fairbanks to Dome, the different creeks, to get a third interest in it from a man that lived over in Turkey by the name of Charlie Clark. My brother and I and fellow named man by the name of Henry Cook, well-known man that got in on Discovery, Gold Discovery on Dome Creek, made himself a fortune there, all right. But the first sinking, there was no thawers, or not what they call little steam boilers that they made by pipe. There was none in the country at that time. So that in our case, We were on Dome Creek trying to sink a hold on number three, quicksand that was 65 and 75 foot holds to it. You use a net method. That was the earliest method we'd use. We start the holes and pick down through the ice and muck till you get to harder stuff, you know, gravel or something like that. But then you can't pick the frozen gravel. It won't pick. No matter what you do, you can't hammer that out. But any kind of ice and mucky stuff, you can pick that down in a square hole, 6 feet by 2.5 or 3, whatever you want room to pick in. Now, when you get down to the hard gravel and stuff like that, you might have any depth. You never know it, you know, 20 to 30, 40 feet, but as far as the depth goes, and you can use all the biggest rocks you can take out, not too big, heat them on a fire, a wood fire, there's lots of wood around at the time, and get them red hot or as hot as they be, and throw them down in the hole after you've cleaned out your hole, and then throw down some moss on top of it. But never go in the hole. You should never go in a hole that you've put fire in until you're sure you've fanned fresh air down it. And in order to do that, if you had to put a fire of hot rocks down in there, and no firewood on top, but you throw the moss down on top of it. And now, in order to have enough to do, to sink and bloody work to, you might start three holes and keep the pretty busy to clean them two holes out and take out just 1.5 feet of the ground that the hot rocks saw. You'll keep going down from day to day. You put them fires in the night and they saw all night when you're asleep. Get up in the morning. But it's dangerous to go in a hole without. You found the fresh air down in there.
Because the oxygen is all burned up in there.
Carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
Carbon monoxide killed two men on the ground of Lima Creek up here in Esther Creek. I was glad I didn't try it myself because the two of them were taken out of on discovery, playing my first taken, and I didn't contest it because at that time that they were jumping ground quite a lot because if you hadn't got a hole down to make a discovery, anybody could go and take it, you know. And that was back in the days of Judge Wilkersham's court. And they decided...
Do you remember any cases of claim jumpers being prosecuted?
Well, I don't know as I have, but I know claim jumpers have lost more than they win. I know there's exceptions in the law that if it goes to the Court of Appeal, or maybe it goes to the Supreme Court, decides it exactly for them for all time, and it doesn't give them the jumpers the ground in no place. It gives the original stakers, if they could prove a discovery of any kind by finding any kind of minerals of anything. But not usually a man will go to work and sink a hole now without staking a claim first. But the law says you must find minerals before you stake. Yes. If it's a vein matter, you got to find the minerals first. You get to know these things when you stay in a mining country as long as I have.
Well, Ben, you've enjoyed your life out there. You've had a good life. You've had a good life.
Well, I never wanted to jump a claim or anything else because I could have. I was afraid to do anything like that. I thought that was a pretty low business of any kind. I could have staked and restaked lots of things like the wood stake. But they restaked my claim, That jumper stick might climb up the Mammoth Creek, and that's a creek over there running into Cripple Creek. And it happened to be a deep ground, but I staked the claim, but I couldn't prove a discovery on it because it was mucked and ice, you know, for 70 feet down. And then the discovery claim was staked. And also number one and number two. I staked a couple of claims for by private attorney for some friends of mine downtown, of course, that I came from there. And he wanted to keep that ground, but I couldn't claim a discovery on it. But you know, they put a hole down on there, and they were down 70 or 80 feet in this hole. And one of the partners that went down in the morning, and they were using fire, hot rocks or something. And sometimes it's all right, but you can't tell. The deeper you go, the more dangerous it is. So that the man which went down the hole, old time prospector, wise, knows everything, know about digging holes. And he went off the chair. At least the chair went light on the man that was on the wheels on top. And he got no answer. Couldn't. And he went run up to the fellows on one above, discovery on Emma Creek, out here, preparatory to Esther Creek, and Cripple Creek, up. Maybe they call that older, they'll just come to weapon. But it runs into the Cripple Creek waters and we're up further than. And the two boys come down from up above. They're supposed to be old-time prospectors, too. And one of them says, well, he says, look me down, he says, and I'll see what happened down there. So the man that lost his partner, Dad, went off the chair. He says, you better fasten yourself in that chair. There's kind of a rope chair and a seat on it with some rope in case that you drop off the chair, too. Oh, he says, that's all right. I know gas when I'm in the hole. He let him down, and he went off the chair, too. There were two of them. There were two of them brought out dead. Them two was brought out dead on that discovery claim that was mine in the first place, but I didn't contest it. And, you know, I thought I was lucky that I didn't get in that part of the... it's pretty gassy, you know, sometimes in the holes. Pretty gassy. Or it's carbon monoxide. If they were using, I don't know. I'm not sure. I didn't know whether they were. I know they didn't have any thawers around in the country at that time, so they must have been using hot rocks, I guess. But hot rocks, you know, where they are up to.
All right, Ben. To wind this up, tell us a little about your automatic dam.
Well. Well, I'll tell you.
And then you decide. You gotta take your time, Richard.
I can explain that if that's them. It's very simple. It's not hard to understand, thing like that. It's simply that you have. there's two ways of making them things. But we'll go to work and on one that I want to explain the first crudest method of one that we had years ago. You build a big box, like a sluice box, only you can build them as wide as you want to. We usually make them 7 or 8 feet wide and as high as water can be built up by shoveling my dam up. If you were, at that time, I made the dam from the hand shovel, you know. See? But to put in an automatic dam, you could have saw lumber. It got no sawmill, your whip saw it, you know. And I know what that is, and I guess there's very few people around here who have tried to do that, but it's really a hard, back-picking job, you know. but to put in plank in the bottom and put up your sides in order to put your plank to it. Then, you know, the water and pressure in the dam has a tendency to spring out, so you've got to tie those from with capillaries on top and bottom, you know, to hold that thing together, and you make a sort of a channel through there, like a square box, you know. And in the center of this box, you use a sort of place where you can put an axle in, like a log. And you build on that a gate that will turn on it, you know. The axle has got to be one-third from the bottom and two-thirds from the top of your gate. When the water rises, it's built in there at an angle. And it shuts, it opens halfway, and the water splits through both on top and bottom. And it hits the log, you know. Of course, it would go clear too far if it wasn't for some bumpers that it hit on. And you build that axle in there, either log or square timber, whatever you put in. You've got to have some journals up both ends, so to grease it up with something, you make it slip and go easy. But if you have not a very tight pitch, you with your gate and things, you can always add a strip of canvas to make a flop to kind of go against the crack of soft water. And this way your dam will fill up much quicker. You haven't got much leak to it. And when the water comes up two-thirds above the axle of the dam, it breaks the gate down, you see?
Yes.
Yeah. So now, after that gate goes down, it has something to stop on halfway down. It water splits through and rushes out there. It's what makes a good ground source. It works wonderful, and it carries off tailings and everything else for 1,000 or 1,500 feet before it gets weak enough. And you could clean the whole length of the whole clam. Just down sluice it off, and then you've got constipation, you know. And they don't go out.
Well, all you need is an axe and a saw to build a dam like that.
Well, that's about all you need. Yes, I could build one on an axe and a saw. The thing is about that gate, you know, I haven't explained it all yet. You want that gate to shut, you see, when the water's run out. Now, if you have a clothesline or some kind of a light wire or something like that, and you fasten it to the top of this gate with a spike or a stapler or anything, and then you have a light log of some spruce or something, and you lay it in about where the pond is, above the dam, and you fasten this wire to that log, and it floats in the water. Then you have a little short wire, and you anchor to anything, a little twig from the other side straight on through, and by the time you regulate these here wires just right, that's when the log, as the water goes out, I might say, for the log goes down, and that when the water's just about out, the log goes down, but it's not quite on the bottom yet, it pulls the gate up, and then what water run down catches the spot apart, the slope like this, and slams it shut. Till it slips again, it works perfect, John.
All automatic.
Yes, it's automatic. Mm-hmm. It's not automatic.
He explained that pretty good.
Now, this is the way to build a big forces of water. You can make them 10 and 12 feet wide, you know. You can make them any height you can make them. But they move more ground than anything else I've ever used. And it's still one of the oldest methods known. They don't seem to have any. Nobody invented this in Alaska. This was made in parts of the southern states where they were mining years ago. But I cut on it, you know. I cut on by hearing talk to some of the old-time Californian people who live from British Columbia. I made it myself. But I don't see anybody else making them. The fact is that, brother, maybe they just don't know how it's done yet. But here's Larry. If you have lumber, or maybe you can use pipe, what I use over there, I just cut the ends out of these drums. And cut the ends out of both ends of the drum, or an oil drum, a 50-gallon oil drum, and put them together and weld them around till I have 40 feet of it. But the last drum I put on the end inside the reservoir. It's got the end in it. I don't cut that out. But I cut that out on the top, you know. See? And I'm going to take another part of a drum and fit it over that with the two ends cut out, you know, but fit it over. Well, now you take a bulldozer and you can put lots of moss around your pipe. Any timber down like that, you can put the moss around that. Tamp it around for a number of feet, and then you can shove the dirt up with a bulldozer till you can cover it enough. You can run right on top of it, you'll not crush it. It kind of packs it, it has a tendency to tighten up everything so tight, and your dam don't leak. Now that's the main thing, to put a dam so they don't leak, you know. In fact, you could learn a lesson from the beavers, they can make them. And I've seen them made so solid that they didn't even go out with the ice in the spring. They stayed right up and the ice tumbled over like a waterfall. And I right on the Tulavanna River there, right at my crossing, I watched them build their dam and I let them do that, you know. It's quite interesting to see them working. Two beavers will build a dam. With a couple of boys cutting the trees down home just like people.
Yeah?
Yes.
A whole bunch of beaver working together.
They work together just like people.
There's a point for your story.
Yes. I would like to say, I seen in a geographic magazine that the biggest tree a beaver cut down was 7 inches. I got one over there that's 17 inches. Two trees clashed together. And they cut it down. And they had all the cottonwood and everything else just at the river where I had the sawmill, that I was sawmill there. I used to water my horses out there at the river. You know, I had to go around kind of a lake and they had a big home already built up in there and they cut hundreds of sticks of birch and cottonwood, and they were all left new chopping. I thought a wood chopper got in there from looking at it from a distance. All over, you know, all the trees I felt wherever I used to drive out water the horse, and there it gave me a chance to study them beavers a little bit. And you know, a tree that's cut down, the oldest beaver generally cuts the longest stick, and I started to measure. By his teeth marks, I know that he was the one that cut that notch, cut that off there. But the next stick was shorter, and that was a different tooth up on the other end. Now, it was like that ways all around in all the sticks. One was a little shorter. On account of the family, that the youngest, when he cut the smallest one, I guess it took that way. And they're all the same length. How do they do that? The big one cuts his length, the little one cuts his length. But you won't get two lengths out of the same, you know, except the big one would have to go to another tree to find his again. But the same length. That's something you don't see.
How do they make those logs lay on the bottom in the water? They'll float.
They, you mean say how they, that's their food. Those logs and those trees are their food. They're not for a dam at all. Oh. They bury them in the water and stick them in the mud and the holes come down. And that's just winter food. They eat that all clean, you know. And put lots of it away like that under the dam that stops the water back. high enough so that don't freeze. And they have to, they know what they're doing. They build a, back up a lake if they can. That's their best deal, is to back a lake up. Then they can, for there's a deep lake, they can leave them at. But on the rivers, there's more brush and there's more trees for them to feed on. They get them right off the bank and then put them anyway in their reservoir, you know.
You getting tired, Ben?
Me?
You getting tired?
No, but I'm...
You're enjoying yourself, huh?
Is that thing going yet?
Oh, yes.
Oh, for goodness sake. You left
I'll let you hear a little after this.
Now, that was an interview with Ben Falls. I thought I didn't get it all recorded. I got a good portion of it, so I was in the home of Tom Radovich taking this recording, and I had Judy Brady, the newspaper, news minor reporter, feature reporter, and she took notes on this, which she will publish. She took some pictures also of Ben. And this was Harry Hughes recording for the Pioneers of Alaska. And hoping that this will be one of the ones that will entice the people of Fairbanks to realize we've got a gold mine here in Alaska that we haven't touched. And that's the history and the stories of Alaska. That's 30 for today. This is just the leader from here to the end. Any sound down here is purely incidental.
Bars. And they showed them me to them in all day's work that I had about five or six little balls the size of a pea. And that was what they'd taken out on these bars in a day, mind you. And then showed them to me there in British Columbia, and I was just...